We're currently headed for a catastrophic global temperature rise of 3 degrees this century. Already, the planet is 1.2 degrees hotter than the pre-industrial average, and rising. Given the pace of global heating and the time lag before our emissions reductions have any impact, scientists are exploring additional ways of reducing global temperature. I'm Gaia Vince, and in this series of Discovery, I'm looking at ways of actively intervening by removing carbon from the atmosphere or reducing the amount of sunlight that heats the Earth. These are often called geoengineering or climate repair technologies. They're still in their experimental infancy, and scaling them up is controversial and may not even be possible. Let's look at what's involved. Trillions of watts of solar energy are continuously striking Earth, powering our planet's living systems. Much of that heat bounces back into the cold emptiness of space. But enough is trapped by the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere to keep Earth habitable. Our industrial emissions, though, are trapping too much of the sun's heat and causing climate change. In this episode, we'll look at ways to bounce back more of the sun's heat using reflective technologies. Making the atmosphere itself more reflective would reduce global temperature. And scientists are exploring the potential of releasing crystals into the stratosphere, an upper layer of the atmosphere where jets fly, to do just that. As David Keith, director of Harvard's Solar Geoengineering Research Program, says, there's nothing controversial about the physics.
There's nobody doubts that it's possible to cool, reduce global temperatures by reflecting aerosols. That's something we've known for, I don't know, 3/4 of a century. That really isn't a research question. The question is, what are the side effects of different ways we might do it? What are some of the risks? What are some of the ways these things might backfire? So some kinds of things that you think would be cooling would actually, you know, end up causing warming or end up causing unexpected changes in the climate. Those are the kind of research questions people are working on. Nobody that I know is just trying to figure out, is it possible to cool the climate? We know it's possible to cool the climate. That's really basic kind of physics and atmospheric science.
Climate modeling studies show that stratospheric solar reflectivity would cool the planet, with the amount of cooling depending on the amount of particles released. One of the most effective options would be sulfate particles. We've already experienced their cooling effect because sulfates are released in vast quantities during volcanic eruptions, and historically have caused so much cooling and solar dimming that harvests failed, leading to famines. And no one's suggesting anything on that scale. The idea would be to release small amounts in a controlled way into the stratosphere from aircraft or drones.
To get 0.5 degree centigrade of cooling requires something of order 1 million tons a year of measured in sulfur units into the stratosphere. And that's something like 2% of the current industrial emissions of sulfur into the lower atmosphere.
So it sounds like a lot, but actually it's a tiny percentage of the sulfates that we ordinarily emit every day with our activities.
Yeah, almost all of sulfur emissions from human activity are from fossil fuels ultimately. And the number is about 50 million tons a year sulfur, although it's going down quite quickly.
So can you just explain why emitting sulfates into the stratosphere has a cooling effect on our atmosphere, but we don't get the same amount of cooling and we get a lot of unwanted effects when these are emitted in the lower atmosphere?
Aerosols anywhere in the atmosphere scatter light in roughly the same way, but you get about 1,000 times more cooling per unit of kind of air pollution damage if you put materials in the stratosphere. And that factor of 1,000 really comes from two reasons. One is that about a factor of 50, because the lifetime in the stratosphere is of order a year and the lifetime in the lower atmosphere is of order a week. So that's a factor of 50. And the other reason is that for sulfur you put in the stratosphere, it turns out that it's about 20 times less effective than sulfur you put right in the lower atmosphere where people live, causing health impacts. So that gives you that kind of ratio that's very roughly 1 to 1,000.
And if we wanted to generate a global cooling effect, by spraying sulfates into the stratosphere, does it matter where we choose to spray them from?
Yes, for sure. If the goal was to produce relatively uniform reflection, to produce a relatively uniform climate outcome, the goal would probably be to put most of the sulfur roughly in the tropics, say between 30 north and 30 south. There's some tuning, but that would be roughly the answer.
Would you have to do it from multiple sites in equatorial regions, or would just one site and then the mixing would take place in the stratosphere?
That depends on the altitude and the aircraft that were used. I think it's conceivable to imagine, depending on the aircraft choice, this all being done from a single site that was sort of near the equator. Certainly unlikely to be the optimum, but largely this is a practical and political choice.
And does it matter what time of year or day or night that this would take place? I mean, what sort of climatic conditions do you need for that optimal mixing?
No, the mixing process in the stratosphere happened on this kind of two-year timescale, so it has nothing to do with whether it's day or night or the local weather.
Sulfates released into the stratosphere wouldn't have the same horrible effect on our health as they do in the troposphere where we live, in air pollution. But there are concerns that they may damage the ozone layer or cause acid rain. So scientists are looking at alternatives as well, such as carbonates or even diamonds. The issue is about whether experiments should be done. And when does an experiment become an intervention? Nobody knows for sure because there have been no outside experiments to test it, largely owing to fears over the technology. Given that climate change is already linked to the deaths of about 5 million people a year, should we at least look into whether solar reflectivity technologies are feasible and whether it has unwanted effects? Earlier this year, a report from the National Science Academies in the US recommended funding for solar geoengineering studies. The report's lead author is Chris Field.
We know quite a lot about the way that reflective particles should influence temperature based on modeling studies. And we know quite a lot about what happens when particles are released into the stratosphere from volcanic eruptions, or when small particles are released into low clouds in coastal zones from looking at basically smokestacks from ships. But those don't provide a sufficient basis of information to really figure out whether this is a program that we could manage. And the report calls for a budget that's sufficient to allow field experiments, and it proposes a set of governance rules that would need to be in place for future field experiments, but it doesn't necessarily advocate for field experiments. It recognizes that there may be some things that we can't learn from laboratory or modeling or natural observation studies, and as we encounter those, we should give serious consideration to whether a field experiment would provide the relevant information with the sufficient number of safeguards to allow us to be confident that nothing would go wrong.
What sort of experiments were you thinking of?
The goal of this program was really to design the broad outlines of a research agenda, and this committee certainly didn't get to the stage of specifying particular experiments. But the kinds of things that have been uncertainties over a long period of time concern issues like different kinds of particles are released at different levels in the stratosphere. How do they spread out? How long do they last in the stratosphere? What are the relative implications on reflecting shortwave radiation cooling the planet or accelerating loss of ozone, which allows more ultraviolet radiation to penetrate to the surface? There are a whole bunch of questions about the technical details of what happens when you release at different heights. What are the consequences of releasing different kinds of particles? And really a lot of uncertainty about everything that follows on after an initial release.
Now, are these issues that you could answer with a very small scale experiment, or would you actually have to do it on a large scale to see what the large scale effects are?
It's a really good question what scale the experiments need to be at and which experiments could or couldn't be done in the laboratory. One of the big challenges that's unanswered with this whole family of approaches for stratospheric releases is whether there are scales at which you could learn the things you need to learn without also driving the scale of the experiment to the level where you might be getting unintended global effects. And one of the key challenges is figuring out whether there is a realistic, viable experimental approach that doesn't cross over into the area of unacceptable risks of global effects. And we really don't know the answer to that yet. It may be that even though there are in principle viable approaches to deploying solar geoengineering, that there may not be an experimental route that gets you there.
There seems to be a lot more going on here than simply a reluctance to try an experiment that might not work. Geoengineering has become highly contentious, loaded with ethical and moral concerns. For some, it's wrong because it's an unnatural intervention in the Earth's systems. But we already add climate-altering chemicals to our atmosphere, which is why we're in this mess. However, there is a fear that if climate-modifying technologies were an option, less effort would be put into mitigation, which all the researchers agree must be a priority. Ben Converse is a psychologist at Virginia University, and he's looked into this concern.
My team have been working with a wonderful graduate student, Maura Austin, who led an investigation in our lab about the potential of sort of an individual level moral hazard. So from a goals perspective, is it the case that people relax their motivation toward mitigation after learning about climate engineering? As motivation researchers, we expected to find this effect. We expected that people would show sort of a trade-off where if I have some confidence that things will be taken care of, then I kind of relax my concern about mitigation. And we embarked on a series of studies expecting to document that pattern and then try to figure out how to sort of adapt it for positive outcomes. We were surprised over the series of studies that we didn't find evidence of that effect. So across 8 experiments that we just published, we told some people about geoengineering. We had participants in a control condition read some sort of control science articles that were not about climate change. And then we measured the extent to which they felt there was urgency to pursue mitigation efforts. And we routinely found no difference. It doesn't mean that there's no effect. It doesn't mean that one couldn't produce a moral hazard effect or a licensing effect in other conditions. But it did surprise us that maybe that concern is not as robust as we would have assumed as motivational researchers.
There is also the issue of how it might be regulated and governed. Jesse Reynolds, a geoengineering policy consultant.
How do we get out of the trap of doing outdoor experiments for methods that probably would need to be global? And I think what one thing that's needed is an authoritative scientific assessment of the evidence to date. And this would provide a shared information base about what the technologies appear able to do. Right now, that assessment is missing. The logical body to do this, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, issues these enormous climate change reports every 6 or 7 years or so. And the first part of the new report just came out, and it only spends a few pages discussing sunlight reflectivity. And I think something more is needed, something dedicated at the IPCC or a similar body, hopefully affiliated with the United Nations, not necessarily so. That could form a foundation for a broader social and political conversation about how this could play a role in managing climate change in the medium term and whether we might ever want to go down that role. And in this, one group that's essential is developing countries. They're the ones who will bear the most risks of climate change, And if sunlight reflectivity goes wrong, they're likely to bear the most risks then as well. So they have the most at stake either way. They need to be brought into this conversation and have a full seat at the table. And that shared scientific base is necessary for such a conversation.
Just as our greenhouse gas emissions have mostly impacted the poorest tropical nations, so too any global cooling emissions would most impact these poorest regions, including by reducing heat, but potentially altering rainfall too. As other contentious technologies have shown, such as research on genetically modified organisms, to build consensus, you need to build trust. And that takes inclusive dialogue. Surprisingly, one of the most heavily regulated parts of the world, Australia's Great Barrier Reef, a UNESCO-listed World Heritage Site, has become the first place in the world to give the go-ahead to solar geoengineering. It comes after a decade of community engagement. Dan Harrison of Southern Cross University explains.
The key is consultation and respect for all of the differing views. So we don't do any field work out on the reef whatsoever without free, prior and informed consent of the traditional owners of that sea country, so that the Indigenous people that were there before settlement. We have obviously a lot of consultation with the stakeholders of the reef, with the Marine Park Authority itself. We can't do anything unless it's permitted. On top of that, we've added our own governance structures within our program, so that the sort of independent review of all the field programs and all of the reports and everything like that on the sort of scientific side. And then even beyond that, we've sort of at the moment developing these community, like public consultation groups, which will be made up from various members of the public and have an opportunity to get everyday people's views into the program as well on the technology and what we should be doing and where we should be doing it and what their values for the reef are.
Coral reefs are facing particularly acute problems owing to global heating and ocean acidification. Much of the Great Barrier Reef has already been badly impacted by bleaching, and it's expected to be lost within a few decades. Dan and his team have been exploring a range of options to counter the deadly heat on the reef, including releasing a film of calcium carbonate onto the water surface to shade the corals, and a technique called cloud brightening.
With cloud brightening, the idea is to try and cool down the water of the reef and also shade the corals, because it's both light and temperature that cause bleaching.
And how exactly do you brighten a cloud?
So you can only do this under very unique circumstances, and it seems so far from our research that we do have these circumstances over the reef during summer when the reef's bleaching. And how it works is that every droplet in a cloud, it needs a very, very small particle floating around in the air to condense around. So for that water vapor to come out of being a gas into a cloud droplet. And under certain circumstances, there's not so many of those particles, and that's because the air coming in onto the reef during summer is coming from far out in the Pacific Ocean. It's very, very clean. There's only some salt crystals and some sulfur-based compounds typically in the air. And so when that cloud forms, because there's not so many particles, that certain amount of water that's in the cloud, it's forced into forming larger droplets. And larger droplets don't reflect as much light as smaller droplets. And so by simply adding more of these tiny little nano-sized salt crystals into the air over the reef, when those clouds form, it's the same cloud, but the droplets are smaller, and so it reflects more light away from the reef. It's a very small change, but if we do this over a couple of months during the summer, it's enough to gradually cool down the water.
So you're not creating clouds where there were no clouds. You're taking a cloud with large droplets and turning it into a cloud with small droplets.
Yeah, so that's one of the sort of beauties of the technology, is that it's replicating a natural process.
You're spraying ocean seawater up at these clouds. How high do you have to spray it?
Yeah, so the technology is as simple as basically taking seawater. And the only other ingredient is of course, we need energy to atomize that seawater. And then we spray the droplets off the back of a boat, And the atmospheric mixing actually does the rest for us. So we don't really need to spray it all the way up to the clouds. We just need to that's one of the main things that we've been looking into in our research recently is just to make sure under what different atmospheric conditions, how well do those droplets mix up to the clouds. But it turns out that again, we're very lucky because during the summer when we want this to work over the reef, the water is incredibly hot, the air is incredibly hot, and so that convection over the ocean, there's a lot of air lifting up and that takes the particles up to the clouds. You know, at the moment, this is very much in a research phase. We probably have 10 years before we're trying to implement this on a sort of a, you know, even a, I guess a large enough field trial to start trying to cool the ocean. And so at the moment, we're really still developing the technology.
Cloud brightening is also being explored on the other side of the globe, where Arctic ice melt is not just impacting local communities, but causing weather disruption and global sea level rise that threatens millions globally. David King heads the Centre for Climate Repair at Cambridge University. David is planning to spray aerosols of seawater into the region's clouds from a flotilla of boats.
What we will have to do is create these seagoing vessels, which are managed remotely, and encircle the entire Arctic Circle region with these vessels, maybe 700, maybe 1,000 of them. And then we only activate those vessels where the meteorologists tell us the wind is going to blow towards the Arctic Ocean and carry any cloud cover over the Arctic Ocean.
And what do these vessels do?
What do these vessels do? They pump seawater up into the atmosphere through a sieve, a nebulizer. And that means that you produce a very fine spray of water droplets. The water droplets have to be very fine and very homogeneous in order to have the impact that we want to develop. At the moment, we're doing land-based experiments. All of these land-based experiments will lead to the building of the first marine vessel. The marine vessel has been designed. And let me tell you, it's a very clever design. Professor Stephen Salter from the University of Edinburgh, an engineer, has designed this. And in essence, it involves using the movement of the water to pump the seawater upwards through this nebulizer. The nebulizer then produces this fine spray of droplets which get carried up by the wind. Now, we will eventually do the first experiment, probably from one of the northern islands of Scotland, up in the Shetland somewhere, so that we don't have interference from other vessels, shipping, etc. And then we will build the first prototype and put it out to sea and test it out to sea.
Here too, community engagement for the technology is key.
I formed this climate crisis advisory group, and one of the members of the group is Tero Mustonen, who's a member of the Sami group of people who live up in northern Finland, equivalent to the Inuit people, and he's a representative of the indigenous people living on the permafrost. I spoke to Tero in May this year. What's the local temperature? He said it's actually minus 30 degrees centigrade. That's pretty cold, but we're used to living under these conditions. I spoke to him at the end of July, so now we're talking about this polar summer, and he was in tears. He said the temperature here is now plus 32, a 62 degrees centigrade temperature rise. And he said, we are reindeer herders. He is a professor of climate science, but he says, I'm a reindeer herder. Everyone in this region is. And we are used to living off the ice. And suddenly, I can tell you right now, I'm looking at a boreal forest on fire. We've had lightning strikes, which we haven't experienced. The same is true of northern Russia, where these remarkably high temperatures we experience. Now, these people live on the permafrost. They have their villages on the permafrost. What happens when the temperature rises? They lose their habitat. They lose what they are used to living on. And I can tell you that we believe there is no one from the Sami people or the Inuit people who would argue against what we're doing.
Scaling this up to actually have a real impact will take many years. Lack of funding is a big issue, and part of the problem is how controversial the issue is. But through more dialogue attitudes could change.
Solar reflectivity may turn out to be, in 50 years, somewhat boring, somewhat mundane. Some experts somewhere are making some decisions and implementing them. It might not be as contentious as you and I envision it being right now.
Meanwhile, as global temperatures continue to rise, we still don't even know what's possible.
We haven't seen the announcement of an integrated solar geoengineering research program or the kind of integrated governance that the report advises. And there is some ongoing research on solar radiation geoengineering in the U.S. It's mainly funded through philanthropic sources. The U.S. government through NOAA has a modest program, a small one. And we're encouraging discussions and seeing some interest across the federal government and optimistic that the report is serving as a useful stimulator of conversations.
The climate crisis humanity faces as a global civilization of 8 billion people is of unprecedented scale and horror. It demands we engage with all our options to maintain a livable planet. This includes preventing additional heating by decarbonizing our energy systems and changing our agricultural practices. It includes hard societal changes to our resource consumption patterns. We must use our unparalleled technological capabilities to withdraw our emitted carbon from the air. And we must explore whether we can restore the temperature of our atmosphere, the life of our reefs, and the ice of our poles safely and quickly.
You've probably been hearing quite a bit about climate change recently, but I've got a little secret for you. Climate change is not all about big conferences, about politicians and their promises and whether they'll actually follow through. Climate change is about how we live our lives, moment to moment, now and in the future. Hi, I'm Neil Rozelle, and I'm one of the hosts of a podcast from the BBC World Service called The Climate Question. Climate change is the burning issue of our time, and it's happening whether it's in the news or not. So The Climate Question is there for you every week, asking tough questions in a spirit of adventure, discovery, fun, and ultimately, hope. We tell our stories in detail, with leading experts, as you'd expect, but also with people in surprising locations around the world, from the high Arctic to tropical jungles, from shiny corporate offices to shanties smashed by storms. That's The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Search for The Climate Question wherever you get your podcasts.